Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to another great episode we have here of Suspense Radio. 2 hours coming to you live today. My name is John Robb. I am your host of Suspense Radio. Today, we have four great authors. Kicking it off first is going to be New York Times bestselling author Lisa Gardner, followed by Deborah Ludford, Harrison Demchek, and then Amy Legnor. So you have a lot to listen to and a lot to get to, and there's no better time because it starts right now. Everybody off and running on this great Saturday morning here in Los Angeles, live to you again. This is Suspense Radio. I'm your host, John Robb, and we're going to kick it off right now with our good friend and New York Times bestselling author, Lisa Gardner, to talk about her latest book, Touch and Go. Lisa, how are you doing today?
Just fine. Good morning, John.
Good morning to you. And again, Touch and Go came out on February 5th, and it's a little bit different in the fact of you brought a character back that was a victim, and now a character, and now the main character is now the protagonist, and that is Tessa Leone. Tell everybody a little bit about Touch and Go, a little behind the scenes of it.
Yes, Touch and Go is my latest thriller, and it involves kidnapping an entire family, which I don't know about you, John, but it's something I've just always wanted to do.
especially if they make you crazy like my family sometimes.
Well, you know, it came to me kind of during family vacation. If you think of how well most family vacations by the end, you know, the dynamics are reaching kind of that critical breaking point, and I'm like, if this is, you know, a white sandy beach, what would it be like if you were, I don't know, thrown in a prison cell instead? Yes, so Touch Me features the kidnapping of a family, and I have a great deal of respect for my editor, Ben, from Dutton, because when I told him I wanted to kidnap a family, the first thing he and I both realized was the normal character I write about, Boston Detective Dee Dee Warren, kidnapping across state lines is beyond her jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
And some publishers would be like, you know, you need to do what you've always done, but my publisher is phenomenal. They're like, it sounds great. Go forth, do what you got to do. So it occurred to me that when I wrote Love You More, at the end of that book, the Massachusetts State Police trooper, Tessa Leone, said that, you know, she had to leave law enforcement due to some of her, let's say, actions she took to get her daughter back. But she's a private investigator. So it's like, that would be perfect because she doesn't have jurisdiction. She could go anywhere. And who better than to try to race against the clock to rescue the Denby family than a character we already know was capable to go to the ends of the earth to save her own daughter. So that became the premise for Touch and Go.
And now, when you were writing the book Love You More, did you know, okay, you know what, the ending of it is going to be this way, and you knew that Tessa was going to go on, or did all of a sudden you're like, you know, okay, I want to write about this book, and then it kind of hits you that, oh my God, I got the perfect thing to do. Which kind of way was it?
Yeah, I never know the ending of my novels, and I don't have a plan book to book. I tease everyone. I'm a non-series writer. I didn't know how Love You More was going to end. I didn't actually even know who had done what till I got there. I thought the book wrapped up great, but Tessa's life is unsettled, and I have to say, really one of the reasons I brought her back for Touch and Go was readers. I have gotten so much mail in the past few years of people just, is she okay? How is her daughter? Did they get a puppy? Do they have a house? I mean, how are they doing? And you could tell readers just, they really felt for her and her little girl, Sophie, and what they went through, and just, I think, wanted that reassurance that they really had moved forward with their lives. And I thought, you know, what better way than to bring her back as a character? So sometimes it's good not to have a plan and, you know, listen to readers and let the creative universe speak and see what happens next.
Because, see, and you said something that was very, very important, because I keep trying to tell this to a lot of new authors coming up, and, you know, they always ask advice. They ask you for advice, which is why, you know, we use your writer's toolbox, which you have online, and you were generously enough to let us publish that in the magazine going forward, because thriller readers today are more character-driven, I think, than plot-driven, because a lot of the plots have been used, I mean, in some fashion or whatnot. It's very difficult to find a brand new one. And so you got a lot of email on your character. And that, I think, is the most important thing, is the character part of stories. And that's what you have to put a lot more time and effort into, is your character. And now realizing you need maybe a backstory and then things going forward and things like that. That takes up a lot of your time.
I think you're absolutely correct when it comes to suspense. I mean, even kidnapping. When I came up with Touch and Go, it's like, I want to do a kidnapping book, but there's so many that's been done. You're like, what would make it fresh? So I'm like, well, I'm gonna have family. But I think the authors you see succeed, you see the books that break through the clutter, people talk about character, character, character. And in that case, I feel like I'm somewhat lucky. That's what I love as a reader, and I feel like that's my biggest strength as a writer. You know, people say, you know, it's like Tessa Leone from Love You More. I mean, people read that book, and they haven't stopped talking about her since. So it was fun to bring her back, and it was fun for me. It's like spending time, you know, with an old friend.
Right, and so when you're sitting there and you're deciding, hey, I'm writing this book about kidnapping, then you start to have to put together and say, okay, now I need a family. Now what's the family going to do? And the interaction between them and that. And then, you know, then you have the villain, and then you have all these things that come in. But the secondary characters, like you said, are the ones that are very important in suspense thriller writing, because those seems to be the ones that people remember a lot, because everybody knows, you know, the Reachers and the Dee Dee Warrens like yours and everything, things like that. But it's those secondary ones that come in. So how much time do you spend on those secondary characters to either maybe they have a stronger voice than you thought they were going to have, or less of a voice, or when you're going and writing the book, how important are those secondary ones to you, making sure that you get those correct?
Well, I love characters. I think when you're reading a book, you know, whether it's a thriller or a romance or anything, you should feel like you know these people. I mean, like, these could be people that live down the street. These could be people like members of your own family. When I went to write Touch and Go, and I was creating the Denby family, I wanted that family you would recognize, because you have to get up and running so fast in a thriller. So I wanted it to be, you know, within five pages, you already feel, oh, wait, I know these people. I could be these people. And I, what I did was I created a family, and they're unique, but they're also a model. I mean, this is the family on your block. You know, everyone has them in the neighborhood that seem perfect. I mean, the larger-in-life husband, the beautiful wife, the perfect 15-year-old daughter. They have the best house, the best clothes, the best jobs. They're the family that seems to have everything going for them. And you know, we secretly wonder about them the most.
Right.
I mean, it's just a human nature. But what's really going on behind closed doors? And in the case of the Denbys, that's a valid question. I mean, they are a family already on the verge of falling apart. Their very perfection has come back to haunt them, and that's before three masked men burst into their house and abduct them using tasers.
Yeah, because a lot of the times when, and again, I always tell people the same thing, whether it's horror or whether it's thriller or whether it's suspense, it's almost the things that you don't write about that are sometimes the more compelling part because it gives the reader the sense of imagination to figure out, well, what's going to happen here? What's going to go on here? And it's the anticipation of knowing that something could be coming, or like you said, what secrets this family holds and those kinds of things. Do you think about all of that kind of when you write, or does that stuff really not come into your head until maybe it's over with and people start writing about it and talking to you about it?
Well, I think we're all fascinated by that whole notion that we don't know what's going on behind closed doors, that danger doesn't have to be something far away that's happening to other people, that can be a lot closer than you think. The last few books I've written, from Love You More, where Tessa Leone is, you know, being accused of killing her own husband, to Touch and Go, where I've, you know, kidnapped an entire family, are what we call the domestic thrillers. I mean, they're absolute page turners, but they're dealing with families, you know, personal situations, you know, the kinds of intense dynamics that, you know, we fall in love and we think we're supposed to be living happily ever after, except you're not. And that, to me, is almost like the beginning of the story. Just when you thought everything was going well.
Right.
Actually, in fact, what terrible things are wrong here. And that really sets the stage for Touch and Go. I mean, you have a family that should have it all, but is actually in crisis. You have a private investigator that's, you know, trying to rebuild the life, having lost her husband, having rescued her daughter, Tessa Leone, and now she's been called to a crime scene that's giving her a sense of deja vu. I mean, a cute little house, everything should be perfect, but clearly it's not. And one of my favorite scenes in Touch and Go is kind of toward the beginning, when you have the investigators trying to piece together what you didn't see happen, like you said, the stuff that was off stage, and you have to use your imagination. And one of the things they notice is, you know, there's like what look like water drops down the hallway, and what the lead detective determines is it's urine. They're actually piecing together the daughter's kind of last stand when she was surprised peeing on the toilet. And it's that kind of little domestic detail that you can almost relate to, too, in the middle of the night, stumbling, go to the bathroom. How horrifying would it be to look up and there's a guy with a taser standing there?
Right.
And that actually,
I mean, it's horrifying just going to the bathroom and seeing anybody walking, looking at me.
Yeah, exactly.
So to find a guy with a mask.
And I just love the thing, you know, her first instinct was to run for her parents' room, but they're out.
Right.
For the night. But again, the investigators, you know, the humanness of that to them, that, oh, man, because, you know, they have kids. And when I do that a lot, I think, in my novels. I mean, the detectives aren't these lone wolf people. I mean, they're members of community. They have families. I mean, they're not just interpreting the scene. They can relate to the scene, too, which makes them all the more determined to get things right.
And, you know, your last D.D. novel book, you know, D.D. Warren book was Catch Me, and that came back. But you took a long time. Because 2008 with Say Goodbye was the last time you didn't write about Dee Dee Warren until now.
Yes.
So how was it kind of for you to have to kind of get out of her world and get yourself into, you know, Tessa Leone's world with Touch and Go, and kind of change that thing up a little bit because you had written with her, you know, for about 4 years?
You know, it was totally seamless. I just don't think I worry about that. I mean, I know Tessa well. I know Dee Dee well. I know the FBI profilers well. If you go to the website, lisagardner.com, you can see that the books, certain subsections of my books feature different characters, but they're all meant to stand alone. You don't have to read them in order. You don't have to follow them. To me, it's almost more like this is the old friend I'm spending this novel with, more than I'm having to worry about a whole different approach to things. And one of the fun things I then did get to do, because I wasn't with Detective Dee Dee Warren, is I got to invent a new character. And I did my first ever New Hampshire police officer. And I got to spend time up here in the mountains of New Hampshire, where I live, with our local county sheriff's department. And it was really insightful for me. I mean, even as someone who researches a lot with law enforcement, you go to the locals, and we're rural up here, and we're kind of hick, and you don't necessarily expect, you know, that, you know, the biggest law enforcement department around, and they're not, but it was amazing to interview with the detectives. I mean, I've never gone any place where I've asked, have you ever drawn your weapon on the job? And they're pretty much every single one's like, oh, yeah, last week, first day on the job, 3 times last year.
Wow.
And just to hear them have to talk about, it's totally different policing. because they are so such a small department. It is so rural. Backup is 45 minutes alone. You get called out to, or you find yourself in a situation, and chances are there's one of you and six of them, and not even a street light. You're in the middle of nowhere, and the six guys aren't really thinking, you know, we need to surrender. I mean, they're kind of thinking there's one of him.
Right.
Our odds are as good as any. And just to hear how much they have to think on their feet and be creative and be good problem solvers, but be quick.
Yeah. I mean, because that's a huge, you know, policing is much different than a Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, to a small town, New Hampshire. I mean, things are different in how you have to do. So, I mean, that would be very interesting to be able to see how they have to police compared to a big city where things are a lot different.
Yeah, I loved how they kind of kept talking about there's two New Hampshires, and I think you can make this a comparison in a lot of states. You know, there's Concord, which is our capital, which is heavily populated. And basically,
right.
You know, even the locals will tell you it's a suburb of Boston. And then there's northern New Hampshire, which is like the wild, wild west, you know. And they're like, you know, city cops, if one officer is called out, six officers are called out. It's shock and awe. You know, rural policing, you're all on your own. You're going to have to think fast on your feet. And one of the things I really loved about Wyatt, the detective in this book, and I got this from the sergeant I was interviewing with, is he's like, you have to really like people. You have to be respectful and genuinely interested, because that trait is what's going to diffuse 95% of the situation. I mean, if you come in like, I'm the lone gunman, but I'm going to hammer you down, the situation is going to escalate, you know, like Tinder.
Mm-hmm.
Just come in, tell me, buddy, talk to me. Let's see what's going on here first. He's like, you'd be amazed how many situations and how many times, you know, there's a guy standing with three knives and high as a kite in a meth, but he really does just want to be heard.
Right. He just doesn't know how to do it correctly.
Yeah, he just wants you to hear his story. You know?
Right. Well, I mean, it was almost like, and again, we're speaking here with New York Times bestselling author Lisa Gardner about her book Touch and Go. LisaGardner.com is the website to find out a lot more information. But it was almost like the same thing that we had here in Los Angeles with the Christopher Dorner. He wanted to be heard on his on what was going on. He just did it in a way that was very horrible and tragic, and this is what he thought he had to do. And I'm sure that thriller writers like yourself are like, aha, I can maybe work with something like this, because this was a real-life cop going after real-life cops.
I think this is the essence of what a good story is. I think writers, you know, we're fascinated by people. I mean, we're the ultimate people watchers, and so are police officers. But I think readers, too, one of the whole appeals of a novel, especially like something like a thriller, is to have that vicarious experience of being swept away and getting to walk in somebody else's shoes. And I think that's why we gravitate to strong characters and compelling characters. I think when you read Touch and Go, you feel for this family. I mean, you do want them to succeed, even as you understand they all have problems. You get Tessa Leone. You want her and her daughter to continue moving forward. And then you meet Wyatt up in New Hampshire. You know, he's a cop who's a carpenter, maybe a carpenter who wants to be a cop. But he's a good guy. And you just, as a reader, it's like you enjoy the time you get to spend with him. It's almost one of those things, I hope, when the book is all done, people are like, but that was a fun crew, you know?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and the book has been out since February 5th. It's available wherever people can buy books and, you know, wherever you can get them. And so what has been kind of the reaction that you received from your fans, especially the ones who, of course, were so immersed into the Dee Dee Warren series, and now you kind of change up a little bit with Tessa Leone in this. You know, what has the reaction been, you know, from the readers that you've been getting emails from?
Everyone has love the book. It's been very well received. You do get to see Detective Dee Dee Warren in the very beginning with her squad handling the initial abduction. So I think for fans, that's enough to kind of at least get to check in, you know, see that she's doing well. And I think it is really gratifying to watch Tessa work to save this family. And I am working on my next novel, which will be available next year, and that we do return to Dee Dee Warren. So for people who want to see her, don't worry, it's coming. So,
Yeah, well, and so, and because you did one thing also with Dee Dee is, you know, in the seventh month, which is a novella, which you brought out here in January 2012, you kind of pieced together a time period of her pregnancy and, you know, things like that, and because you kind of pieced, you know, like I think it was like a 9 or 10 month, 12 month process. Do you have any plans of maybe doing that again, or is it going to be more like real time with your next book? So it's kind of like after Catch Me and a little touch and go, and then it's just going to move right in, or is there a time frame?
I don't get too precise on the time, but she's married now, she has a child now, the child is older, so it's kind of in sequential order. But one of the things I have to do if I'm going to go back to return character, such as a Boston detective, is I need something fresh and interesting to go on in her life. So it isn't just the same old, same old. And so for the next novel, what I came up with that has me really excited is I actually terribly, terribly maim her on the first page. She's actually injured working a crime scene to the point where she cannot return to the job. But the killer is still killing people, and nor is she the type of person who can sit on the sideline.
Mm-hmm.
So you have an injured Detective Dee Dee Warren trying to figure out, well, if she isn't a detective, who is she, and just how many boundaries can she push to find out the truth of what happened and to catch this killer, because there's just no way she's going to sit around in her bed drinking, you know, chicken noodle soup. The world goes round.
Right. And that's the one thing is that, you know, now that she's married and has kids and everything else, I mean, when you look back at Dee Dee from the very beginning to, you know, how she is now, I mean, that's just plain life, and that's how, you know, priorities and things are going to change, and you know, recklessness or whatnot might be a little bit different. So you kind of have to write that dynamic a little bit different to kind of keep the character relating to just everyday life.
One of the things I think readers really like about Detective Dee Dee Warren as a character is she has that real world struggle with, you know, who am I and what's my role and how do I do all of this right. I mean, I think for a while, thriller novels always had kind of the lone wolf, hard-boiled detective. But one of the things that always strikes me when I interview law enforcement is the family people. They're active in their communities. They have kids. They go to soccer games. And when you talk to real cops, that's much more what they're kind of struggling with. How do you balance a job? Well, it is beyond normal hours, and it is really a calling to serve. It's not just that you're going to work at 2 a.m., but that you're not going to come home till you get it right, because this stuff really matters. But at the same time, you don't want to abandon your wife and kids or your spouses. And I think for Detective Dee Dee Warren, I think readers relate to that humanness in her. She is trying to figure this all out, but she doesn't have any more magic answers than the rest of us yet.
Right.
She just gets up each day and fights the good fight, you know.
Yeah. And, you know, and when people go on lisagunder.com, now I know that your tour is wrapped up here in the United States, but you're doing something very exciting is South Africa, and like we kind of talked about a little bit over, is this is a little bit different dynamic from the United States media to the European and kind of how they do things. I'm still sitting here thinking, I mean, it's just so much different in how those things react. So you got to be extremely excited to go to South Africa for this.
Yes, I will be spending a week in Johannesburg and Cape Town for my British publisher Headline. And one of the ways a lot of the European publishers do it in general when you go out on tour is they have the media come to you. So there's that, you know, that great movie Julia Roberts and Hugh Grant was in, Notting Hill. I think you see her as the actress do it, where you are like confined to a hotel room and all the press literally line up outside and come in and, you know, have their 15 minutes, 30 minutes, 5 minutes to speak to you. And it's just, it's like this parade of press. And your job is to sit there and keep smiling and drink your water. And you know, 8 hours later sound just as clever now as you did.
Yeah.
While you stared at the same wall.
I mean, at least you know what you're going to be getting into, because it's going to be much different than the more laid back, I guess United States kind of way that they do things. It's a little more laid back, a lot more laid back compared to what it seems like they are over there in Europe.
Well, they're very kind. I mean, eventually they bring you wine. Authors, you know, we pretty much work for wine. So, you know. But, I mean, it's an amazing part of my job now because I am an international relations major. You know, when I was growing up, my dream was to see the world. And I think one of the coolest things about being, you know, particularly a suspense novelist because it has such global appeal, is my job does take me now to see the world. I mean, sometimes, you know, one hotel room at a time. But you know,
right.
I mean, to get to go to South Africa for someone like me, I mean, that really is a dream come true. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, and then I'm just sitting here thinking, if they're giving you wine, it would be more interesting to be one of the last people to interview you because you could be a little bit more wacky with them than you were at the very beginning with all the wine that you have in here.
I have to say, if you're an American on book tour, you do have to learn pacing because, you know, especially if you go to the French market. I mean, wine at lunch is civilized. Where wine at lunch, if you're an American, just makes you stupid by two.
Right.
So you do have to, they are going to quote you. So, you know, proceed, you know, with caution.
Exactly. Well, I'll tell you what, Lisa, we want to thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about your book, Touch and Go, and wish you nothing but the success and, you know, be safe over there in South Africa. We'll catch up with you maybe sometime on the road when we catch you on some of events, you know, later, and it was just great talking with you again.
That would be fabulous. Thank you so much, John, and enjoy. You have some great authors coming up.
Yeah, we do. So enjoy yourself and have fun, and we will speak with you later.
Okay, thank you so much.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
So again, everybody, that is author Lisa Gardner, and her book is Touch and Go. LisaGardner.com is the website to check everything out about her. Deb Lefford is going to be coming up next, and we're going to be getting to that. I do want to let you know that the show today is sponsored by Simon & Schuster Gallery Books and the debut novel of Jamie Mason. There is very little peace for a man when a body buried in his backyard, let alone three. So read Three Graves Full, the acclaimed debut novel by Jamie Mason, available wherever books and ebooks are sold. Visit www.jamie-mason.com for more further details on that book. And so we will be right back after this break here and talk with author Deb Lefford. And in the meantime, the break's going to consist of this. And I'm just trying to figure out which one. Let's go for something wacky today. And here you go. everybody, I want to welcome you back here to our second segment of the show, and we are thank Lisa Gardner for being on here earlier, and now we are going to shift to our next author, and her series now is in book three of her Deputy Stephen Hawke Enola Wyella thriller series. It's called Crescendo. It was preceded here by the first two books, Staccato and Snare, and author Deborah Luckford is on the line. So, Deborah, how are you doing today? Thanks so much for coming on.
Well, thank you, John. I'm doing fantastic. I really appreciate this. I'm a huge fan of Suspense Magazine. Oh, I read every single word every time I get it.
Oh, that's so nice. And we didn't pay you for that one. Normally, we pay people to say that. So let's get into Crescendo. Kind of the tagline you have written down is Redemption with a Bullet, and it is book three. So give us a little bit about, and if you want to kind of, you know, give us about the series and then leading up into this book, you know, that would be good, too, for people that are maybe just finding out about it and wanting to know, you know, if it's a trilogy or if it's going to continue or all those types of things.
Great. Yeah, it is actually a trilogy, and Staccato was the first book that came out, and they're all standalone stories, but the law enforcement characters are the ones that are carried throughout. Staccato was a classical music-themed thriller that takes place exclusively in the Great Smoky Mountains of western North Carolina. And then we go to Snare, which is the Hillerman Sky Award finalist and also the New Mexico Arizona Book Awards finalist. So I'm very, very thrilled about that one. That one takes place in western North Carolina, and then the action moves to the Taos Pueblo Indian Reservation, which is how it qualified for the Hillerman Sky Award nomination. And that one is about a rock star in peril. Crescendo, I've my publisher and I decided we should stay with the same musical theme for branding purposes, but Crescendo doesn't have any music involved at all. It really is primarily about Enola Wyella and her journey to find a boy who no one believes is missing. No one but her believes is missing. There's a her and her partner go off on a traffic stop. She's a city cop, Bryson City police officer, and so there's a traffic stop, and just everything goes wrong. And that's pretty much where Crescendo starts off.
So your character, Stephen and Enola, going back into Staccato and up through Crescendo, kind of how has their dynamic been, I guess, interaction with each other? You know, what kinds of things have they kind of had to go through to get up to now, to this point? And did you know that this was going to be a trilogy when you started writing it, or did it just kind of end up that way when you first started going on?
Well, I knew that it was going to be a trilogy primarily because my background is in screenwriting, and so, you know, every script is completely different. So but I knew that I could do three. And I probably could do more if I absolutely had to, but it really is set up for a trilogy because there is I like to think that all of the stories that are involved, all the subplots come full circle. But Enola and Stephen Hawke, their relationship, you know, evolves as most do. She's barely mentioned in the first book in Staccato. And then in Snare, they've just started dating. In Snare, it's about a Native American pop star who is in peril. And so that's primarily why I initially wanted Enola to be Native American, because I wanted that, that friction and that conflict that could possibly happen between Stephen Hawke protecting this very young and popular and beautiful rock star, and then he takes her to the Taos Pueblo Indian Reservation to keep her safe, leaving Enola behind. So I really wanted that friction to be involved. And then in Crescendo, she, you know, steps into the spotlight. She carries the entire novel. And Stephen Hawke, you know, they are now living together. They have their own home. It's a year later, actually, from Snare to Crescendo. So their fiance, you know, and they're ready to start a new life. There's all kinds of conflicts going on, but you know, they love each other, and hopefully, you know, we'll make a new life together.
And when you use the, because you use the Native American angle in Enola, because you're saying that, you know, she's the only female Native American officer in Bryson City, North Carolina, how much research did you have to do, I guess, with Native American customs and, you know, and things that they do and religious things that they, you know, believe in order to give that character, you know, breathe the life into a lot of believability, because that's, you know, that's a challenge when you're when you're doing something like that that's kind of outside of the norm, to be able to give it, because you don't want hate mail coming back and saying, they would never do this, and then you're like, oh, God, and then you have to deal with that.
Right. Well, yeah, it's an interesting challenge. In Snare, I did all kinds of research. I went there. I worked, you know, hand in hand with their representative on the Taos Pueblo, and when he didn't know something, he went to an elder, and if he didn't know something, he took it to the tribal council. So I had a lot of help with Snare, because there are a lot of customs, and it was very, very important to me for that book to be absolutely 100% correct as far as representing the Taos Pueblo people and the region. And Katina Salvo, who's the lead character in that one, you know, to know that she could absolutely be a real person who stepped off of the Taos Pueblo and made it, you know, internationally as a pop music star. Now with Walela, she's Cherokee. I'm also part Eastern Band Cherokee, and I grew up spending all of my summers in the region where Crescendo takes place, and where all of these books take place. So I can't say that she's me at all. I mean, but I feel like I could wear her skin. Do you know what I mean?
Right, I gotcha.
Yeah. So she is more. She doesn't really accept her being a Cherokee. She is Cherokee, and she's the only one. She's the minority city cop in this small town, but she does. She plays by the rules. Now, the secondary character that comes in is her grandmother, Elise. And she, however, is completely traditional, very, very traditional, lives on the reservation in North Carolina, is a successful rug maker. She's a weaver.
Mm-hmm.
But she's quite wealthy because she sells them, you know, nationwide to big art dealers and so forth, but she pretty much shuns her wealth, and so I was as true to that tradition, you know, that being on the reservation, and yet still working in a successful field as far as the arts go.
Okay, and things also a little different when you're going from. Because you said, you know, your background is you've done a lot of screenplays and a lot of film, and now when you're, you know, when you're having to write a book, you know, things are a little bit different in how you have to bring it across to the reader. How was the change of that, being able to do that, and when you're looking back at your first one, Stagnato, in the trilogy, to be able to, you know, sit there and say, okay, I got to kind of do things a little bit different and get things across like that?
Right. Actually, I'm really glad that I started out as a screenwriter because, you know, as you read my books, you'll see that I'm very, very particular about visuals. I try to set every scene so that the reader is right there with me before I start the action, you know, immediately from the top of the scene. I like the reader to know where they are before I hit them with something, you know, suspenseful or tragic or ominous. So with the screenplay, you know, it's primarily the visual and the dialogue, and so you know, I like the real tight dialogue within a book, and the visuals, and I think maybe that's a little bit what sets my work apart from the authors who are not screenwriters, who don't have a visual or creative or arts background, and that it's sometimes you'll read and it's, you know, there, it might be a little stilted, or it might be, okay, he's here now, or now she goes here, or now he felt this, or now she smelled this. Whereas I prefer, even when I'm reading, I prefer, you know, for the author to really help me with the senses and putting me right there in the scene with the characters.
And again, I want to remind everybody, we're speaking here with author Deborah Ludford and her book Crescendo, and it's really the third book in the trilogy series of Stephen Hawking and Enola Wayola, or
Wayola.
I suck on last names. God, I suck on them.
I know,
okay.
It's Cherokee. It's difficult.
Yeah, and your website's DeborahJLedford.com. Make sure you put the J in there. Otherwise, you're going to go to some place you're not going to find out any information. So DeborahJLedford.com to find out more. And so we're looking at the book here, Crescendo, and this is the last one, like we said, of the trilogy here. When you were finished, did you get the sense of, I got everything in there, or it's like, damn, maybe I should do something and continue it on, or you kind of got a little sad, or how was it when you finally wrote the end in Crescendo?
Yeah, I was really, really sad.
I didn't want to hear that. I don't want you to be sad.
I don't know. I mourn a little bit whenever I finish a project, even if it's a short story. It's kind of, you know, I think it's the releasing it to the world and where,
right.
You know, now it has to stand on its own, and I'm not the mama anymore to protect it. You know what I mean? But
mm-hmm.
But yeah, I get a little sad. But also, I think it's a good thing when I don't usually get too emotional, you know, when I'm working on the work. But there was one scene very close to the end where I actually did cry a little bit. So I hope that the readers will too. But you know, just knowing that I can move people with the words, that's really important to me. I try to stick one scene in each of the books that I hope will draw enough emotion to maybe even pop a little tear out.
Yeah. So do you think that we're going to be seeing these characters again sometime? Do you have any plans for anything else going forward? Are you going to pull maybe somebody out from the trilogy that you didn't think would be as big of a voice as they ended up becoming, and like you want to explore them more? What are the plans that you think that you're going to have with the characters in the future? Or is it going to be something totally different? You're not going to do anything with them.
Well, I think maybe down the line I could do a novella between Enola and Elise, because I just love those characters, and I love the relationship, and their back and forth banter has been, it was so much fun to write. So something, you know, like that possibly. But, you know, I started another series, I'm primarily a thriller writer, so I did start another series, and then I started thinking, well, I don't really want to be known as a Native American author. You know what I mean?
Right.
Native American author writing about Native Americans. Now, Louise Erdrich, you know, does it so well, and I can, I mean, even just to speak her name is she's, you know, she's my idol. But I don't know, I because I have so many story ideas and so many ideas that I am working on what could be a standalone thriller, but also a very traditional young adult mystery. And I know listeners are probably rolling their eyes thinking, oh no, another suspense writer writing, you know, working on a young adult. But, you know, I think that we as writers have to be true to what comes to us. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's just like the characters in my series, Stephen Hawk and Enola. I mean, they came to me. Stephen Hawk is an African American. He has always been from the screenplay days. I mean, and nothing was ever going to change that. I mean, I had a couple of agents at one point saying, oh, well, if you change him, you know, it's like, no, I'm not going to change him. And a couple of editors at big houses saying, oh, well, if you, and it's like, no. I mean, there are some things that you just have to go with your gut, and that it's just not worth it for your, you know, your creative karma to to back down on something that you really, really want to see happen. For instance, with Snare, there was someone, you know, a big wig who this is before I was with Second Wind Publishing, of course, but I was pitching Snare, and they wanted Katina Salvo to be a white woman, say from Chicago. and it just like, no, that negates the entire purpose of of, you know, of her going to the Taos Pueblo, which then, you know, negates anything with the Native American element. It's just, it was just, you know, silly.
What the hell is wrong with people?
I understand
publishers and editors' point of view on some things. It's like, well, it's almost like the music scene too. Okay, look, we got to sell books and we got to make it to where, you know, we have to sell. But, you know, I mean, I think what true readers really love is the honesty that the author is not going to cheat them out of something that a publisher, editor wants to put in there just because they think it's going to sell.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't make any sense. It kind of takes away the art. It's almost like telling Picasso, no, fruit scenes are really big now. Can you paint us a fruit? It's like, well, are you serious?
It's so true. It's exactly right. And that's what happened with Staccato. And why I know it, I mean, it, I, you know, that was put in a drawer. I knew it was never going to be published because it went through literally 99 rejections. Agents.
Now, is it 99 or you just, is it 100? You just don't want to say it, or is it really 99?
It might have been 104. It might have been 104. But I'm telling you,
99 sounds better.
You know, but, I mean, and I kept hearing, oh, we love the characters. It's a very interesting location. We don't know about this place. It really sounds interesting, but it's too literary for a thriller, and it's unlike anything out there. It's like, well, isn't that the point? I mean, to be original? So,
right.
You know, and I, you know, if you change this and this and this, and again, it's like, you know what? No, I'm not going to do it. I'll put it in a drawer.
I'm surprised they didn't sit there and say, can they be fighting a vampire or something?
Well, this was years ago, but yeah, I mean, nowadays, yes, they probably would say that.
Yeah, it's like, can they be fighting a vampire, or can you make it to where the vampire and the werewolf, like, fall in love and something like that? How about that? Yeah, because that hasn't been freaking done 17,000 times.
Yeah, you can keep it on the on the reservation, but can you?
Yeah. Can you bring the vampire in, or can you bring the werewolf in, or how about a ghost? Okay, yeah. How about you write the damn book then, because you sound like you know more than I do. I know, I mean, I get what you mean. But the great thing is that you were able to get out the books, and you were able to get them out the way that you wanted them to get out. So the reader's going to know that this is something genuine from you, and that's what makes it all the better to know that this is kind of how, you know, it's like the director's cut of a movie. This is how the director wanted you to see it, not how
exactly.
An editing person said, this is how you're going to see it.
Exactly. And that's where, you know, I have to absolutely give the kudos to Second Wind Publishing. They're a small independent company, publisher, not so small anymore. I think they have 120 titles or something now. They're out of Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And I had submitted, you know, after giving up on Staccato, I submitted the manuscript to it was Court TV, now it's True TV, but they were looking for the next best crime writer or something like that. It was an online type of a you know contest, and so I submitted it there, and it went on to the semifinal round, and the publisher Second Wind was actually trolling for talent, and they approached me, so that's how I got my publisher, but I'm telling you, I mean I. You know, and I had the concept for the cover that I wanted to use was from a poster that I found eons ago. They allowed me to keep that, you know, keep the same visual, which is, you know, I call them the hands series. So it was on Staccato. It's a pair of hands. You can see hands at a piano keyboard, and the hands are clasped in handcuffs.
Right.
And then in Snare. It's you know, hands clasped in a rope, and then in Crescendo, it's hands cradling a police officer's badge with the mourning band over it. So I knew that I wanted to keep that concept through the whole thing.
And they're chained, and the hands are chained in that.
And the hands are chained, right? So it's you know, working with a small independent publisher. They will let you do that if you sound like you know what you're doing and you're competent and you're professional and you don't ask for too much. But they have allowed me really to present the work that I want published, that I want to see, and that I want to read.
Well,
I mean,
well, damn, I'm mad that Suspense Publishing didn't know about this and we were able to get a hold of you. Damn, that stinks. But the good thing is that yeah, I mean, it's out, and now you're going looking towards the future. And so, what kind of do you have coming up into the future that you're writing now? Are you going to be out at any places where you know people can kind of check you out, and you're doing some book signings? You going to any conventions? Where can the fans kind of meet you and speak with you at?
Oh, I'd love that. I will be at the Tucson Festival of Books, which is,
okay,
I believe it's the fourth largest book festival.
That's a
now.
Big one.
Yeah, it's huge. It's in Tucson at the University of Arizona. That's March 9th through 10th. So I will be at the Sisters in Crime booth and also the Murder We Wrote booth. And then
Murder
also I'm
Wrote.
Going, yeah, Murder We Wrote. And I'll also
like
be
that.
At Left Coast Crime.
Okay. Where is Left Coast this
That's
year?
Going to be at Colorado Springs.
Oh,
and that's
okay.
March 21st through the 24th. I've got a couple of panels. I'll be appearing there. And, yeah, so I'm excited about that. And then coming up in September, I'll be going to North Carolina. I'm going to start my publicist, PJ Nunn, with Breakthrough Promotions. She's going to be scheduling some appearances for me in North Carolina, which is, you know, where the series is set. So I'm getting excited about that. And I,
so,
you know, my,
yeah. Go ahead. Oh, no, you go ahead.
So, yeah, I'm just, you know, doing some guest blogging and so forth and so on, and some other radio spots coming up.
Yeah, and that's a nice dynamic, too, is you're able to hit a lot of people, you know, like back, you know, 10, 15 years ago, or actually probably less than that. I mean, you were doing a lot more book signings and having to go into bookstores and doing things, but now with the internet and with radios and things like that, you're able to do a lot more publicity than you had, you know, in the past. And that's something that makes, I think, a little easier change for somebody who's not used to going out there and having to sell themselves to an audience, because when you're writing screenplays and things, you're the ones not selling it. The actors and the people have to sell the film. But now you're out there on your own books, having to do that. Was that quite a challenge for you to have to do, to get out into the public and meet them and talk with them and do those things?
It is. I'm glad that I have had, you know, some experience with the speaking in front of people. I was a moderator for a very large critique group, so and I'm the president of the Sisters in Crime Arizona chapter. So I'm used to being out there, but boy, I still, I still get the flutters. So yeah, new authors coming out there, breaking into the scene, and I advise them, look, you know, you need to start getting your online presence right away, website, you know, make friends on Facebook and Twitter, and because that's where so much of the promotion goes on. It's
really
important.
The social media is really a big thing. I mean, I still call it weapons of mass destruction, but I do know that it is a big way for people to get out there and have to do things. But, yeah, I mean, it is very difficult. And I know that you guys, and I know a lot of authors still, you know, a lot of them are kind of shy when you go meet them at events. I mean, they're more shy to meet you than you are to meet them. And that's one thing that a lot of people have to understand. When you go meet an author, it's like if they're a little reserved, it's just because they're not used to having to really interact with people. They're used to being at their computer in their pajamas and writing.
Exactly.
You know,
that's
what they used to do. Yeah.
It's so true. And it is, and it's, I mean, it's scary to put yourself out there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, because you just never know what people are going to say and what they're going to think of your book. And that's kind of always scary.
Right.
So now, with Crescendo, is there one particular kind of scene? Is there one kind of sentence maybe or area where you think, you know, this is kind of the essence of the book? This is where you think that, you know what, I really got this correct, and this is what, you know, fans are going to realize when they read it.
Mm-hmm.
So is there one particular scene in the book that you think, without giving maybe anything away, that you really think that you got correct?
Well, I think chapter 4, I mean, it's only about 21 pages into it, and this is where the culmination of the entire, you know, entire whirlwind of the crescendo of the entire book begins, is the traffic altercation And it looks like it's just going to be your standard traffic stop. And it was the scene that came to me that made me realize I could write an entire book around. And it's essentially Enola and her partner stop a car, and there's a woman in the back seat, and she's frantic and screaming and crying, and Enola's partner takes the driver back to the cruiser, and Enola is left to deal with the passenger and trying desperately to figure out what's going on. The woman keeps saying, "Where is my son? Where is my son?" And she comes out of the car, and Enola draws her pistol because the woman is clutching a bag, and Enola doesn't know what it is. And the woman reaches in and starts throwing cash into the air. And that's what I saw. That image right there is what I saw, was a cop with her pistol drawn, a woman with her hand clutching a handful of bills, and money flying into the air. And that's that was like, okay, I can build an entire novel around that scene.
And there it lays, everybody. And Deborah, we want to thank you so much for coming on to talk about your trilogy and, of course, your latest book, Crescendo, starting with Stagnato, Snare, and then Crescendo. DeborahJLedford.com is the website. And, Deborah, you have a good day. We will see you hopefully maybe out tour or out and about. And if you have anything else, always contact us. We'd love to have you back on. And you
oh,
have a
fantastic.
Good one.
Thanks so much, John. I appreciate it. Had a blast.
All right. Thank you. Have a good one. So, again, everybody, that was author DeborahJLedford.com is her website, and her book is Crescendo, the third in her trilogy series. We are going to be back here after the next break with author Harrison Demchek, and he's going to talk about his debut novel called The Listeners. And I just want to remind you that the show today is brought to you by Simon & Schuster Gallery Books and the debut novel of Jamie Mason, because there is very little peace for a man when a body buried in his backyard, let alone three, is read three graves full. The acclaimed debut novel by Jamie Mason, available wherever books and ebooks are sold. Visit www.jamie-mason.com for much more further details on that one. So we will be right back here after this short break to talk with Harrison Demchek. And in the meantime, here you go.
I'm not afraid to
welcome back, everybody, to the beginning of hour two, the last hour here of Suspense Radio today. Again, we want to thank Lisa Gardner, who was on before, and Deb Ludford, who was just on our show to talk about their books. Now we have ourselves here a debut author who's coming onto the scene. His name is Harrison Demchick. It's harrisondemchick.com, D-E-M-C-H-I-C-K.com. And his book is called The Listeners. Harrison, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
So we're going to, when we kind of look and see, you know, when people are going to notice and look at the book, they're going to, you know, of course, the first thing they're going to see is the cover, and it's going to be more looking like a horror kind of thriller book. Give us a little bit about, you know, the book, behind the scenes action of The Listeners.
Well, The Listeners is a coming-of-age story in a horror-thriller context. In a borough quarantine due to an airborne illness that causes deformity, insanity, and death, a 14-year-old boy named Daniel, orphaned by the plague, is caught up in a one-eared gang-slash-cult called The Listeners. But all he really wants is to find his best friend, Katie, trapped elsewhere in the quarantine.
So what we kind of have, so it's, you're, we kind of have the dynamic here now between Daniel and Katie. It's more, and so it's kind of, would you consider that there's a lot of emotional connection between the two, and, you know, being 14 years old is kind of another little dynamic because, you know, kind of having to be an adult, really, in the book to have to, like, coming of age kind of thing.
Right. That definitely to both of those. I mean, while it is a horror novel, it's also primarily and fundamentally a character story. Daniel is very much, like, without his mother, wherever she's gone, Katie is Daniel's, you know, really last connection to what life was before, and in a lot of ways she is the most important person in the world to him, and what drives him through, you know, a lot of sort of whatever else is happening to him. He very much wants to see Katie, and very much hopes he will see Katie again. And it's that friendship really that is at the core of the novel, for better or for worse.
And so when you decided, hey, this is something that you wanted to write, were you kind of looking more at your character, Daniel Raymond, and Katie, as the basis of the book? Did you have kind of the idea and the plot of the book that you wanted to do? What kind of came first in your mind when you decided to write The Listeners?
Well, The Listeners had a roundabout developmental process. It was originally a series of short stories, and the series of short stories goes all the way back to the summer of 2005, when I was starting to prepare work for my senior semester in independent study in fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And so it certainly wasn't Daniel first. The first in the novel as it stands now, there are a number of interludes. There's other stories taking place within the quarantine, and actually the last of those, the one featuring a character, a mother named Esmeralda, that was the first story that emerged. So what came first was really the concept. I wanted to write a series of short stories that were connected, and I was looking for a premise I could write these stories around. And that's where the quarantine comes from. That's where the illness comes from. Then the characters became people who would populate this world, and with that first short story, the listeners themselves emerged. The one-eared cult that is at the center of the book. And Daniel came shortly thereafter, and he wasn't quite the same as he is in the novel. He was actually 17 in that first story. He's dropped down to 14 at the pretty end. It's a, you know, significant difference between emotional development at those ages. But Daniel and Katie were emerged at that time as one of several stories in this world, in this quarantine. And it was only after a lot of other development that it became about them, and that development was adapting the short stories into a screenplay. And doing that, once I decided I was going to do that, it was a matter of determining what story had the most to it, which one could work best in that form, which one could be developed into a greater narrative, and that was always going to be Daniel's story and what he experiences in being brought in by the listeners and with them and without them as his story progresses. And so, you know, the screenplay developed around that, the novel developed around the screenplay, and it became very much about Daniel.
And so what was your thought process when the short story had Daniel at 17 and now the book, The Listeners, comes out and he's 14? What made you decide to kind of age him back 3 years instead of just keeping him kind of the same as he was in the story?
Well, it was a gradual process. He was 15 at one point in the screenplay too. He's gone gradually backwards, and that really was mostly a meeting of what I was actually Daniel and what I was actually writing. The story kept writing him younger, and it seemed to be what best fit the character as he was emerging in my mind, and certainly what makes most sense for something that's ultimately going to be a coming of age story. That his innocence is so much more pronounced as a 14-year-old kid, and that element is so fundamental to his character and the things he experienced. That to have been somebody who was as sheltered as he was before all this happened.
And when you're starting out and you're writing horror kind of as your debut, and you kind of have the romantic, I guess, kind of undertones with it. How difficult was that for you? Because you got to kind of have that, you got to kind of have that subgenre when you're writing within a genre book, and you decided to have it kind of a little bit more romantic. Were you very conscious of the fact that you know that you had to kind of have, kind of both working together simultaneously?
I wouldn't consider it romantic necessarily because the relationship between Daniel and Katie is very much a best friend relationship, and that was very important to me that it not be a romantic subplot, that it really genuinely is a friendship. I think there's more innocence and more childhood in that. And that was the kind of relationship that certainly also meant the most to me in the writing. But as far as balancing the elements, the fact of the matter is I wasn't really thinking of this as a horror novel as I wrote. I mean, it clearly is, and that's the right place to categorize it. But for me, I was just always writing Daniel's story, and everything else was more of the world he was occupying. It was I certainly wasn't thinking about horror tropes to check off. In fact, the truth of the matter is that I was not a big reader of horror at any point when I was writing this novel. It's only after that started to get into it. It's just the way the story around Daniel came out.
Yeah, I was going to ask that too. Because a lot of people, debut authors, you're going to kind of write the genre that you were growing up reading and that you were drawn to. So you were not kind of drawn to the horror genre as you were reading. And now that might have changed recently, but what were you kind of interested in? What were the kind of books that you were reading when you decided, hey, this is something that I want to start doing?
I was in eighth grade when I realized that writing was something I could actually do for a living. And at that time, I loved Douglas Adams, and that's about as far from this you can possibly get. I'm trying to remember if I had discovered Vonnegut yet. I know Salman Rushdie would come later, but fundamentally I was reading a lot of Spider-Man comics. And that Spider-Man comics are a fundamental part of my development as a writer. And you know, I am proud of that. But
yeah, comics are great. Hey, I mean, Brad Meltzer is one of our friends. I mean, you know, he's a huge comic writer, and you know, when you write comics, you have to be just as precise with your storyline, because there's a lot of stuff that goes into them. I mean, you can't screw those things up, and you have to be very detail-oriented. A lot of people don't realize that when you're reading comics, how detailed those things have to be, because those fans like myself, because I collect comics, will go crazy if you screw up our characters.
Oh, absolutely, and I've very much been in that position of going crazy, but it's not just being precise, it's also doing it very, very quickly and on a monthly basis. I mean, I am and have always been a devoted comic book fan. I mean, I was, of course, reading a lot of other things as well, and I was a fairly obsessive reader for most of my life. It just with the exception of Goosebumps when I was young, it's just never really been horror on anything resembling a consistent basis.
So, this is your debut novel, and again, we're speaking here with author Harrison Demchick, and it's harrisondemchick.com. The book is called The Listeners, and since this is your debut novel, you kind of had to go on through the journey of, okay, you know, you write the book, now you send it out, and you go agent-wise, you go publisher-wise. How long and how was that journey? Because that can be extremely nerve-wracking, more than just trying to get a book finished, to now you have to get it published and have to get people to read it.
My journey is a bit unusual in that I've been in the publishing industry since the same summer of 2005. I started working on the short stories, and that I started an internship as an editor, and I've been a working developmental editor in the industry since I graduated college. So I was, you know, very familiar with the world and the process, and the listeners happened to, you know, as it developed simultaneously with working at a publishing company, I actually wrote the screenplay, or adapted into a screenplay at the behest of my boss, and it was a story that he really loved. So when I wrote it as a novel, I actually didn't have to go through the whole search for a publisher process, because, you know, because I already had a publisher who was very interested in the story. And, you know, there certainly could have been the process of seeking you know, audience with the big seven or six or however many there are left of them now. But the industry is in a very much shifting place. I didn't feel like that was necessarily the path for me and for this book. I wanted to have it out there to sink or swim, as it would.
And now that you're out, now, of course, I always tell people that, you know, for authors, almost writing the book is kind of the easy part, but getting it sold and read and getting out to fans is the more difficult part. So how is that dynamic for you to be able to have to kind of go and put yourself out there with the fans, to be able to talk with them and interact with them? Did you kind of feel reserved when you did that? I mean, was it kind of easy? How has that transition been for you, having to, you know, do shows like this one?
It's certainly not been easy. I mean, I was prepared for it because you know, I've worked on getting other authors' books out there for, you know, for years, and in fact, you and I have even spoken before on in that department. With a book I edited called The Samaritan. But being prepared for that, knowing what the situation was, doesn't mean it was something I was particularly able to do, because that's always been my least favorite part of the business. I've gone through so many uphill Sisyphus-like battles for books I believed and worked hard on, cared about as editor. For quite a while, I decided I was not going to pursue publication for The Listeners because I did not want that fight. Because I didn't feel like, just being in the industry as long as I had, sort of jaded the whole thing for me. And I wasn't sure it was worth it anymore. And enough people convinced me that was dumb, that I'd written this novel and it was good and people should read it, that I decided that I agreed with them that it had that I wasn't going to let this be in a drawer for the rest of my life. But this whole thing is certainly the part that I have been afraid of for a long time. It's not been as terrifying as I thought it would be, in all honesty. But it's still not my natural skill. I am an editor. I'm a writer. I'm not a very good self-promoter, but I'm doing my best.
That's okay. I mean, a lot of times we're not that scary, but we can kind of be kind of boring. I listen to a lot of other shows, and I really sit there, and I go back, and I go, you know, I try to make, even like our show, you know, we try to make more entertainment than just sitting there and letting you just say, well, tell me about your book, and then you kind of talk about it, and then it's just kind of like, okay, bye. And so we try to make it, you know, kind of easy. I mean, that's kind of why, you know, we always say that we're kind of like the Entertainment Tonight of thriller writers, because we like to know who the author is, because I think it makes for a much more interesting aspect to the readers to know who you are kind of outside the books and things like that. And so that is hopefully makes it a little easier to come like on a show like ours, because then you just, we're just like talking back and forth with each other. And we're just,
absolutely,
you know, and you're talking about your work. And I know you got some new stuff probably coming up. And are you still writing short stories? Are you looking at those kinds of things? You know, what do you have kind of coming on the horizon as you go forward?
I have a bunch of different things. I'm working on a screenplay that I quite like and I've wanted to really push forward with for a while. I did start a short story I like to do more with. I'm working on a musical, a zombie musical.
A zombie musical?
Yes,
now that's interesting.
I am available for all to see, trying to pitch it on somewhere on YouTube. So if you were to, I don't even know what you would have to do to find it. It's not under my own name. But it's out there somewhere for anybody
okay.
who's old enough to find it. But I'm doing that, and I'm working on some other songs. And basically, I'm doing a number of different things, and eventually one of them is surely going to step forward as the thing to pursue. But in the meantime, I'm letting them all build gradually.
And now, when you with the listeners and with your next book, is it gonna kind of be along the same lines? Is it gonna be along the same genre? Are you gonna kind of do you have any characters that you kind of maybe fell in love with in the book that you want to maybe explore further? What can we going to see that way from, you know, your books and any more books writing going forward?
I honestly don't know. If I was to pursue the short story as a book, that would probably be in a similar genre. But on the flip side, the screenplay is a dramedy. I don't have any immediate intention to go back to the world and the characters of the listeners. I have no immediate plans for a sequel. I don't even know if the next thing I do will be novel form. I don't know that another novel will come. It's really a matter of what ends up best fitting whatever idea comes to mind. And as I said, even the listeners with short stories before it was a screenplay, before it was a novel, and this just happened to be the right final form for it. Not that the screenplay isn't still out there. But it's just a matter of letting the process go where it will.
So you're just kind of taking things in stride and kind of how things go and whatever the, you know, situation kind of presents itself is kind of how you're going to hit it.
Right, exactly. I don't want to force anything into its wrong form. It'll emerge properly eventually. I don't think you're working
on it. And now you also have some free stuff there on your website. Tell us a little bit about, you know, what people can get when they go to your site, the things that they're going to be able to see, the things that you have, you know, talked about, and things like that.
Now, that's interesting because you're the first person to comment on the free stuff on the website.
Are you kidding me? It's freaking free. How can you not comment on free shit?
That's
it's free,
I thought.
People.
I was very much made a point of having that page. I wanted there to be that. But the free stuff you can get on the website is you know, of course, there's a usual thing like there's a preview, and the preview of the listeners is one of the short stories that appears in the listeners, one of the interludes that I had mentioned. There's also a short story that that, you know, at this point has only existed in my college literary magazine. It's a very different thing. It's a funny story. It's very weird one called Elephants. And finally, for anybody who has a particular interest in the development process for any piece of writing, I have the original short story, The Listeners, which is the one we were talking about, where Daniel was mm-hmm. was 17, and a lot of other things were different. It was a first person narrative, whereas the novel is in third, and but it was a starting point. It was the original idea. And I certainly don't recommend that anybody read that before reading the novel. The novel should come first. But I wanted to have that up there, sort of just to show that development over time and how one thing becomes something very different.
Right, because it kind of gives what it does is just kind of enhances more of the art that you created with the book, which is always a good thing too. With that short story, and I think that lends to a lot more, intriguingness that people would want to, explore further. But hell, free stuff! I can't believe no one talked about free stuff.
Nobody's talking about free
stuff. Just so I can get free books.
Yeah, that's what I think.
So, you got a lot of things coming up going forward. You have a lot of stuff that's going on your plate. Are you still an editor at your publisher? Are you kind of doing this full time now? What's Harrison doing?
I am very much still an editor. I mean, my developmental editing is my day job, and I do it half the time at the publisher, half the time at Editorial Boutique Ambitious Enterprises, and working primarily with helping authors very much like myself develop their manuscripts in every aspect to get them to their strongest points. And so I'm doing that most of the time, and the rest of the time, working on getting The Listeners out there, working on getting various screenplays out there in Los Angeles, and working on whatever weird writing idea happens to come up along the way.
And so you're kind of like the last thing here is since you are an editor, we've never really had an editor on the show. What can you tell authors that are coming up that are thinking of writing or have written or kind of going with the journey? What's the one thing, because they asked me the same question and I just, but what's the one thing that you can tell them, look, make sure your book either has this or make sure you do this, because this will be the number one reason why you probably don't get published is because you didn't do this.
Well, it's hard to say one specific little thing because there's so many different things that different writers have issues with. Not just there are different things that different writers do especially well, but broadly, if you're going to submit the manuscript to places, do make sure that you get a professional eye to look over it and to give you that kind of specific feedback, into plot and character development and setting and every other thing that makes a story work from the ground up. So that you need to get your best foot forward when you're competing with so many different people with so many different manuscripts. And the same thing applies to if you're taking the self-publishing route because you want your work to stand out. And I tell people the difference between a writer and an author is editing. An author edits and takes the time to make their work as strong as it can possibly be.
And that doesn't mean your mom edited it and said that you were good. I call that the American Idol syndrome. Okay, your mom's going to like anything you do, but you need to have somebody else freaking do it. That's going to give you honest opinions on your work.
Now I will say that my mom does give me honest opinions, and the story wasn't ready to go until it got her approval.
Okay, well, that's good. As long as your mom is honest, but you have, too many moms that are just like, oh, honey, that's a great job. And it's like you're just kind of setting yourself up for failure, and I always find that funny.
You need feedback from somebody who is not legally obligated to be nice to you.
Right. That's the not legally obligated to be nice to you. That, I'm going to use that. Thank you. Well, I'll tell you what, Harrison. I think you've done a fabulous job here coming right out of the gate with the book, The Listeners. And again, harrisondemchek.com is the website. Is there anything else you kind of want to add before we kind of wrap it up going forward, or anything else that, you know, you want to make sure you talk about?
Well, if anybody happens to be in the West Reading, Pennsylvania area, I'm doing a signing there on March 5th at 5:30 with a fellow horror writer, Carl Alves, and I certainly love to see anybody, and that's at the Wise Owl Bookstore. If anybody wants to come by, I'd love to see him.
Well, and there you go. And again, harrisondemchek.com, you can click on events. You can find out about that signing and everything else. And we want to thank you so much for coming on. Looking forward to see what you got going on in the future. And, you know, contact us and we will talk further.
I appreciate that. Thank you for having me.
All right, Harrison, you have a good one. Thanks a lot.
You too.
So again, everybody, that is author Harrison Demchek, and the book is called The Listeners, and harrisondemchek.com is the website to find out more information. We will be back here with our last guest of the day of the show here. Name is Amy Lignor, and her book is called 13. It's a little bit different from what she normally writes, as it's going from her YA into more of an adult. But we're going to get into all that, and I don't want to ruin it right now. But I do want to say that this show today was brought to you by Simon & Schuster Gallery Books and the debut novel of Jamie Mason, because there is very little peace for a man with a body buried in his backyard, let alone three. Read Three Graves Full, the acclaimed debut novel by Jamie Mason, available where books and ebooks are sold. Visit www.jamie-mason.com for further details and all of the books that Simon & Schuster Gallery have going on. We appreciate everything that they bring out because it's extremely great writing. So again, we will be back here shortly in about, who knows, whenever I feel like come back, whenever I get a drink. And we will see you again with Amy Lignor. So hold on, everybody. Here you go. Thank you.
back, everybody, and thank you for listening, however you're listening and wherever you're listening and whenever you're listening, because whether it's live or archived, we're glad that you are listening to Suspense Radio, because it's time to get your fiction on. And now we're here with our last author of the day. Her name is Amy Lignor, and she is the author of the book called 13, which is a little bit different from her because she was used to writing some YA, and this is now going into the adult realm. So, Amy, we want to thank you so much for coming on today. How are you doing?
Oh, thank you for having me. Doing really well.
So here it is, volume one of the Talent and Lowry series, set kind of back a little, 1902, Carnegie Hall kind of thing, and then you kind of bring it forward. So tell us a little bit about 13, a little bit about the characters. When you say book one, that means we know there's going to be a book two and maybe a book three and maybe a book four. So give us a little bit about the characters and your journey kind of into this new realm of adult away from your YA.
Absolutely. Well, there will be a book two and a three and a four all the way to number seven.
Yeah.
That's how many are going to have. That's how many are in this series. It all started, actually, I'm the daughter of a librarian, and I am very much into the New York Public Library. I am very much into history. My mother is a research librarian, and, you know, where everybody else had iPads and television sets, we had books. And I love everything, all history, ancient history to, you know, World War I and World War II, anything and everything I like to read up about. And I started this book in the New York Public Library, of course, my favorite place. And the main character is what you would call quite a saucy, sarcastic librarian, who's a lot of fun, likes to tell jokes, like me. And she comes across a person who is in her library, but a man by the name of Gareth Lowry, who is what you would call an adventurer who is definitely on a quest. And he is on a quest to find something very specific that actually was buried by Andrew Carnegie back in 1902 in the foundation of the New York Public Library. Once all this comes out and she figures out what he's doing, she goes on the quest with him, because you are talking about a woman who is extremely smart and knows everything about history. And they end up going from the New York Public Library to the haunted Winchester Mansion that's out in California, of course. And they end up in Glastonbury. They have to do a little trip with through Jack the Ripper territory. And this is all present day, though. This is not like they're going into the past and meeting Jack the Ripper. But they end up in Whitechapel trying to find something. And then they end up in Glastonbury at the end. So it's very much like you're taking the Da Vinci Code and shoving it in with Indiana Jones and adding some humor in there, and it's just one gigantic adventure. And each book will be a separate adventure leading up to the big finale.
And so when you stepped out of your YA comfort zone and kind of got into more of the adult realm, was the thinking of, you know what, this is just something that you decided, hey, I need to get out into the public. There's the, you know, you couldn't hold back any further, and so this was just a time that you really wanted to bring this out, because either the characters you wanted to were intriguing, the story was intriguing, because I love historical fiction. I love going back and seeing, you know, all those things. And when the reader takes me on that journey across different globes of the world to see how they're all kind of interconnected, I just love to see those things.
Well, that was a favorite of mine. And Leia was the one that was in my head. I could not seem to get away from this character who I believed readers would have a whole lot of fun with. And when I started, I actually fell over this subject by mistake, because I was literally just sitting with someone one day and we were speaking about astrology, which I'm not actually very interested in. And I came across the fact, I'm not really, she was very interested in it, but I came across the fact that there are not 12 signs, there are 13. And the last sign was actually thrown out by the Pope, who did not like the last sign. It is actually It ends up actually the man with the snake around his neck that's up in the sky, which the American Medical Association ended up using as their logo. And that 13th sign, however, has a great deal to do with something that happened a long, long time ago in ancient Greece. And it is, yeah, I'm trying to say this without giving away too much. And, but it's tied into the New York Public Library, believe it or not. So I did I dove right into the research, and I spent at least 2 years researching all these different areas that I wanted to use. And Leia became very much an obsession for me, the journeys that she has to go on and revealing all of these extremely interesting facts that haven't been revealed before. This is not anything like the Knights Templar or anything like that. These are very different facts. And when I stumbled across the Winchester House, which is, you know, out by you guys,
right.
I stumbled across the fact that she was very obsessed with the number 13. There are 13 stairs, there are in her staircases, there are 13 chimneys, there are 13 everything. She was extremely obsessed with that number. And she has a window in the Winchester House, there Winchester did, that is still there, and it has 13 orbs, 13 circles floating around the sun. And oddly enough, that picture ties in to the exact same fact I found back in ancient Greece, which tied into the New York Public Library. So all of these things began building and building, and it got to the point where I literally had to bring Leia to the readers out there. And after book one, all of a sudden book two came up, and I've already written 5 of them, actually. So
you have, five of them already finished.
Yes, I'm heading to the 7th. Toward the 7th. So right now I'm working on number 6, which will actually be in Russia, and the 13th sign that you see in 13, I found a fact buried about it that has a lot to do with Rasputin and a Fabergé egg that was made for the prince who passed away. So it's becoming all wrapped up, all tying together, and so 7 will be the final.
And again, we're speaking here with author Amy Lignor, and the Write, W-R-I-T-E, companion.com is the website to find things out. But you have some other websites, too. Mention them real quick so people know exactly where they can go to find out more information about this.
Certainly. If you're looking for just 13, there is a blog about 13, and it's under www.talentandlowry. And talent is 2 L's. T-A-L-L-E-N-T, and Lowry.blogspot.com, and that will be dedicated to this series. And then the YA, for people who are looking for that, that's under www.theangelchronicles.com, which is also doing very well. I was very proud that as well reached many people, so, and it doesn't have a vampire or werewolf in it, so it was very nice that happened.
And when you go on there and you start looking down, you already see that the second book is named The Sapphire Storm,
yes.
And that'll be coming out, I'm not sure when that one's coming out.
We're looking at April.
Okay.
That's The Sapphire Storm, and then the third one will be called The Hero's Companion. And for those who are into ancient Greece, the hero's companion was actually Athena. And she has a lot to do with the New York Public Library, believe it or not. So that's a whole nother journey.
Wow. Yeah. Okay, so real quick, because there's a question I've been dying to ask, and you're probably the perfect person to find this out. Is there really a ghost in the library, in the basement of the New York Public Library, like in Ghostbusters?
I'm sorry, I have to go with no. I'm going to have to go with no on that one.
But I hear it is haunted. I'm sure that there's probably some hauntings that might go on in that library.
Well, a lot of people believe that the hauntings come from the actual objects that were put into the library, such as Charles Dickens' desk is there, the Bible is there, one of the originals. So they have the Gutenberg Bible, and they have a whole bunch of actual artifacts from writers, authors, and, of course, back through time, back through the publishing history. So, you know, who knows? Maybe Charles Dickens is walking around in there trying to figure out why he's in New York City.
And the thing is like you just said, you know, Athena and the New York Public Library, there's a lot of mystery now surrounding just the New York Public Library that now you're exploring that a lot of people probably didn't know. What was one of the biggest things that you found out about it that kind of had your head turned like, wow, I had no freaking clue that this was about the public library?
Well, the biggest one that blew me away was the first thing I found out about it was that Andrew Carnegie was actually part of a group that used to meet at his Carnegie Hall. And there were 13 of them, and they worked together. I don't want to say bearing because that sounds terrible. They worked together protecting secrets. And mm-hmm. Carnegie was very into protecting literary secrets. And there is an old story where he met up with Aleister Crowley, who, of course, a lot of people still believe, you know, was the devil, et cetera. And of course,
hey,
he wasn't. He was
Ozzy
just a young
Osbourne
man who liked
Alistair
to call
Crowley.
Him.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, Crowley has his little place on Loch Ness, which is also in the book 13. And I found out a whole bunch of information about Mr. Carnegie that I didn't know. And when the cornerstone was laid to the New York Public Library, people believed that he had put something in that cornerstone. And that information sort of disappeared over time. You know, when the lions were placed there, that became the big thing. And so the cornerstone was forgotten about. But there is a great deal of actual facts about Andrew Carnegie and that cornerstone, which is what opened up this whole world for me.
And so, again, a lot of your fans know you from the YA part. And what do you kind of have to tell them to kind of say, you know, from the YA and now into the book, into the book 13, how would you kind of let them know the transition that they need to be able to say, look, this is a series that you feel very strongly about that is extremely interesting with great characters. How is that, you know, how have you been able to kind of overcome that? Because that's a very difficult thing to do.
Well, the fun part and the easy part for me is the fact that The Angel Chronicles is a YA series that is very much dependent on history, and it's very much dependent on what you may or may not believe. There's a lot of facts in the book. There's a lot of fiction in the book, and the people who loved the angels will actually love this because it is just because the character happens to be older, the actual plots are all still historical, and they are all still full of thrills and chills that you didn't know were coming. And mm-hmm. it's very interesting because I will get letters from the people who are the YA fans who have gotten 13, who will say they raced to their computer. The minute they got finished with the book, they raced to their computer to look up all these places and to look up all these facts, and they said they were so interested in it that they couldn't get away from Google. And that was great because it's the same thing that people actually said about the YA. I would say mm-hmm. things about, you know, the YA, the second one was about the Gilded Age, so there was a great deal of history about New York City in that book and various things that happened there. So the people that love that love 13 because, again, it's a journey into something you've never heard before. And you go to your computer and then you just sit there in awe going, oh my God, that's true. So
right.
If you're a YA fan of The Angel Chronicles, you're going to be a huge fan of 13 and that series because you're still getting the same thing. You know, I mean, the plot is certainly different than The Angel Chronicles, but the actual history and the journey and the fun and the facts are still there. It's just a whole different group of facts. So you're still going to go on this journey. It just happens to be adult fiction. And the people, of course, the YA fans, though I have to say, 60% of the YA fans are adults. So it's a great thing to see that. So they're being able to transition more.
Yeah, I mean, they call the genre young adult, but you find that a lot more adults are reading young adult.
Well, yes. I mean, they call it YA the second a 17-year-old is in it. But, the whole point is some of these YA books that are out there, I have to say, are just fantastic. The plots are amazing, and these authors are coming up with such amazing things. And, of course, YA got so big the second Harry Potter hit that it's just been out of this world. And it's sort of an easier transition nowadays for people who like YA because they can go into adult fiction getting the same type of thrills and chills just in a more adult arena. But they're still getting exactly what they liked from the YA. So it's working out well. And, of course, you know, with mine, there's no – unfortunately, if you're looking for, you know, another Edward and Bella, you're not going to find it with me. There's no vampires.
Oh, that's a damn shame.
Isn't it a shame?
Oh,
yeah, I don't even
man.
Have a barking werewolf, so who takes his shirt off. So that part won't come with me. But if you're very interested in – suspense and thrills and chills, you'll get that instead.
Oh, no more of them. Oh, I can't. How am I going to make it through my day now? Oh, I know. Probably the same I do every day without having to worry about
that. It's a broken heart. Not smashing them, of course. Don't get me wrong. I'm very happy that young readers went back and started reading, and Harry Potter and things like Twilight can be appreciated for that, but I like the very factual adventure. I'm very much a Da Vinci Code fan, I'm not into the Knights Templar, but I'm very much a fan of that, where you can literally get the whole world buzzing about something.
Did you read the book Holy Blood, Holy Grail?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did.
Yeah,
I liked that very, very much.
That one was that was a very interesting book, too, and that's a very good historical kind of, it's not really a historical fiction book. It's more of a historical factual book, but it's a little bit different. But it's still one of those great reads that all goes along with the thing, because there's so many mysteries out there in the history that will probably never be solved or been taken as far as they could possibly take them to the point of this is what we think probably happened, and it's just it's just a consensus of a bunch of people saying, yeah, this is probably what did happen. So when you're writing a book like 13, you're able to kind of explore and put your kind of own spin on the historical facts, but you still have to be, I guess, a little careful in making sure that you do, that if something changes to what you thought was going to happen, you have to change up your book because it was all of a sudden a surprise.
It is. I mean, you can sit down. Writers have very different ways of doing things. Some people can sit down and write out an entire outline of their chapters. I cannot do that. When I start going, it's very much like the character takes me where they want to go. And so things that may have started out one way, I mean, end up another way. And it even excites me and it surprises me. It's like I'm reading the book for the first time and not actually writing it, but reading it. And I get so into what they're doing and where they're going that it's just such a thrill to do these books, these Talent Lowry books, because A, Leia is just a blast to hang out with and readers will find her a blast to hang out with. Garrus is very interesting because you're taking, Indiana Jones and mixing him with James Bond in a way. And the journey itself and their relationship, because they're very humorous and very back and forth, it all ties into this really great story. So I not only get to have an adventure and a journey and find out facts I didn't know even existed before, but I also get to get closer and closer to these two people and see just how much fun and they have. So you get caught up in the relationship and the characters as much as you do the actual mystery of it all. So that's what really thrills me with it.
And so why seven books? What made the number seven so important with the connection of this series?
Well, actually, readers will find out when they read the book. There had to be seven, and you will find out why. Like I said, when I first wrote 13, I thought it would be over, that it would be done, that it was by itself. But then all of a sudden, a door opened up with the help of, like I said, a research librarian as a mother, a love of the New York Public Library, and a company called UNESCO that organization. UNESCO studies and tries to save all these places all across the globe, and they really are trying to protect ancient history. And some of the things you can come across with the various places they're at, from Petra to Greece to Rome, wherever they go, you will find out some very interesting things from them. And with Leia and Gareth, I can use various facts like that and turn it into just this explosive adventure that you wouldn't believe, but you will run to your computer and look them up, and you'll see that some of these things are very, very true, and that's what gets you so excited about it, that this all could have happened exactly this way.
And that's kind of the intrigue also along with the series, and you along the way learned a lot of different things. And, you know, you keep probably learning, like you said, you have five done, you're going, working on six, getting into seven. So the journey for you, now that it's coming close to an end from writing the book, how are you kind of feeling personally-wise?
Well, when all is said and done and Leia and Gareth are wrapped up, it will be highly emotional, I think, for me. I've been on a journey with them for a very long time, and now readers are starting to get to see it. And when it all is said and done and Leia has to say goodbye and Gareth has to say goodbye and I have to say goodbye to them, it's, you know, as any author will tell you, it's very emotional. It's, you know, you've been with them for a very, very long time. I don't know. It's going to be hard to walk away when it's all done. But I also am a person who believes that when it's done, it's done. Carrying it further and further and further, I really think ends up hurting the story in the long run. You know, you don't want anyone to get bored. And you want to leave them when they're at the top of their game, and everyone is excited with what they did. So the entire series is going to come at you, and things are going to come out of the woodwork. I mean, people are going to get sick. You're not going to know why. You're going to be on the edge of your seat because you're not going to be sure what's around that next corner. And that's what's fun about them. The Angels, unfortunately, are coming to an end. I just finished the third one, and it's a trilogy. So right now I'm going through that emotional state with those two. So, you know, Leia and Gareth are kind of a definite savior for me because I'm still with them. So we'll see what happens next. I'm not sure what will happen next.
Right. And so you got all these things kind of coming together right now, and you're probably – are you looking to the future beyond any of this? Do you even know what's going to happen after the Angel Chronicles or after the seventh book here of the Talon and Lowry series?
Well, actually, yes. I do have a YA book that I'm working on now in my head at the moment, and there's also a suspense novel that I'm working on right now in the adult world. So I have steps after they're all gone, but Leia and Gareth are just so much fun, and it's such a great ride right now that I'm sticking with them until everything is said and done before I move on.
Well, again, Amy, I'll tell you what. I mean, we want to thank you so much for coming on and sharing about the series now, starting with the book 13. It's book one, people, and the Talon and Lowry series is going to be seven, but now the only book one is out. So there's no excuse for you to not be able to join in the exciting world here of Talon and Lowry with Book 13. Historical fiction fans of Da Vinci Code, fans of Steve Barry, those types of books are going to just love this. And we want to thank you so much for coming on again, Amy. The Right Companion, Right, WRITE.com. And the other one with Talent and Lowry, TALLENT, and Lowry, .blogspot.com is the blog area to find out about the Talent and Lowry adventures. So, Amy, it's been fabulous to have you on. We want to thank you again for coming on, and we look forward to seeing you in the future and talking with you again as book two and then three and then four in the series come out and seeing how things progress.
Well, thank you. I had a wonderful time. I can't wait to hear what the readers have to say. We've already gotten more than a few saying that they want it on the big screen. So who knows? Maybe Talent Lowry will take up where National Treasure leaves off or something. So that
you
would
know,
be fun.
You just never, ever know in this wacky world that we live in today, I'll tell you that.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
Surprises the hell out of me every morning. Yeah, I'm surprised
exactly.
every morning I wake up. So.
Exactly.
All right. So, Amy, enjoy yourself, and we will talk with you later. And, again, thanks so much for coming on.
Oh, thank you so much. I enjoyed being here. Have a great one.
You too. Bye-bye. So, again, everybody, that was Amy Lignor with her book, 13, the first in the Talent and Lowry series. You can find it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It is available in paperback, available in ebook form. And we want to thank all of our guests here for coming on the show today, starting off with New York Times bestselling author Lisa Gardner for her book, Touch and Go, followed by Deb Ledford and her book, with her series, Crescendo, the third in her trilogy series, then Harrison Demchek with The Listeners, and now Amy Lignor with her book, 13. A lot of stuff going on. Again, today's show was brought to you by Simon & Schuster Gallery Books and their debut author, Jamie Mason, and There Is Very Little Peace for a Man with a body buried in his backyard, let alone three. So read Three Graves Full, the acclaimed debut novel by Jamie Mason, available wherever books and ebooks are sold. You can visit www.jamie-mason.com for further details and all that Simon & Schuster has to offer. You can, of course, visit simonandschuster.com and see all their authors and all their books. We want to thank them so much for sponsoring today's show and further ones. So, again, everybody, we will see you here coming up in the future. Check out SuspenseMagazine.com. Click on the Suspense Radio button to see when our next show is. I guess I could tell you if I'm just being lazy, but I have to click on it here. And our next show is actually March 16th, coming back with Allison Brennan and John and Caitlin Stewart. We'll probably add a couple more guests. But until that time, we want to thank you guys all for joining us today. Have a good one. Enjoy yourself. See you guys all March 16th. Be safe out there and keep reading.